Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A lot of very interesting developments in the past few days. We've been trying breathlessly to make sense of it all. And when it comes to making sense of much ferment and less clarity, I can't think of a better person to talk to about it than my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is, of course, not only a senior fellow with us, he is not only, of course, the director of our China program, but a man of great expertise on the strategic environment in which we find ourselves. He is the author, co-author with Lan Chao Han of Understanding the China Threat, but his writings address a whole variety of other topics as well, including many in Epoch Times, The Hill, and elsewhere. We're very pleased to have him now as a columnist at the AmericanGreatness.com website with our other great duty expert on the subject of China, Jim Fennell, Captain Fennell, United States Navy retired. Brad, it's great to have you with us. Congratulations on this new role, and we look forward to mining your products and Jim's in the days to come.
Oh, thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Let me start by asking you about Russia. And I know you're not an expert on Russia, but you certainly bring great expertise about, again, the kind of role it has been playing, notably of late in Ukraine and beyond. But Brad, also you understand very well the kind of, well, they call it no limits partnership that Vladimir Putin has forged with his friend Xi Jinping, the dictator of communist China. We'll talk more in the second block about China, but just again, a quick assessment by you as to what has happened in Moscow and what it might mean for Putin himself and, well, for that matter, for us.
Well, Frank, it's been a stunning few days, and truly stunning. We really seem discombobulated with the events that are happening in Russia. It appears that Prigozhin's Wagner group mutinied against the Russian military, essentially, and Putin's rule. The Wagner group was a mercenary group, but had been strongly supported for ammunition and for logistical support by the Russian military. Prigozhin had serious conflicts with the defense minister Shoigu and with Gerasimov, really the Russian chief of staff. And it appears that he attempted a mutiny that was aborted as his convoy reached Tula, so still some distance from Moscow, it appears that it melted, that essentially it evaporated. All that was solid melts into air, as Marx once said, with this attempted mutiny. So the consequences of this principally are two. First, Putin is weakened by it. Where you have this infighting, it doesn't look good for anybody, and it certainly doesn't look good for the purported strongman of Russia. And the second strategic issue is, now will Xi Jinping execute regime change against Putin? Because Putin is a weakened leader as a consequence of that. And does Xi Jinping have somebody waiting in the wings who could step in here? If not, then the devil you know probably than the devil you don't know, and that Putin is weakened and is going to continue and still serves his strategic objective from China's point of view, which is he's occupying the West. The idée fixe of the West is Ukraine, and so and seems unable to concentrate on other issues. That is the tremendous growth of an expansion of the Chinese Communist Party. So those are
I was very struck on that point, Brad, over the weekend. Of course, the Sunday shows featured all of this prominently, and the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, back from his ignominious performance in Beijing last week, clearly had as his principal talking point that we are focused on Ukraine. And if he said it once, he said it 30 times in the course of several different shows. It was amazing. But his Ide Fix, as you say, is further evidence of how successful the No Limits partnership has been in deflecting attention from where it, I think, clearly is very urgently needed, namely with respect to China. But again, before we get to further details on China, Brad, it's a fascinating thought that Xi might have the ability to engineer the toppling of his friend Vladimir Putin. There is no honor among thieves, as they say. And your suggestion that things could get even worse in terms of the leadership of Russia, maybe more to the liking of China, but not so much to the rest of us, is a distinct possibility here. But do you have evidence that Xi has that kind of ability to orchestrate the replacement of Putin?
His ability to orchestrate the replacement is driven by Vladimir Putin himself and Putin's decision to invade Ukraine and to enter into a dependency, a subordinate relationship with China, thus giving, if you will, the keys to the kingdom to Xi Jinping. Now, in some respects, the Russian leadership seems to be a dog's breakfast in terms of Gerasimov. I mean, a military coup, I think, is unlikely, and Shoigu might be an alternative to Putin, and there may be others as well. But I am absolutely convinced Xi Jinping is a communist leader. He knows about communist governments and totalitarian leadership. And so I'm sure he's done, if you will, scouting reports on a variety of Russian leaders. So
and has built relationships with a number of them, too. Absolutely. I mean, he has not put all of his bets on Putin over the years.
Absolutely. Sure. And Putin is supremely sensitive to this, which is why Rodenko, the deputy foreign minister, rushed this weekend to meet with the Chinese foreign minister and the vice or the deputy Chinese foreign minister to reassure them, it appears, that everything is okay and Putin is still remains in power and there's nothing to worry about and nothing to see here in terms of these events.
Yeah. And yet, of course, there is. And I guess the question, and you and I had an opportunity to take stock of all of this with our colleague, Andrei Ilarionov, a man who actually worked with Vladimir Putin for a number of years as the chief economist in Russia. He's now directing our Russian program at the Center for Security Policy. His insights into this ferment, and in particular, why Prigozhin stopped, I found very interesting. It sounds as though a bodyguard, a former bodyguard of Vladimir Putin's, who is now the governor of Tuzla, as you say, and the surrounding area, must have, I assume, told him you will be killed if you take another, you know, kilometer towards Moscow. And that prompted a reconsideration. And now his precaution, that is, departure for Belarus, where I imagine he's a marked man. It's unclear how long he will survive this. Do you think
he'll find it very difficult to buy life insurance, Frank, given these actions? Also, Andrei conveyed that Putin had threatened his relatives and that the senior leadership of the Wagner group also had their relatives threatened, that if they were to continue the mutiny, their loved ones would pay the price.
Yeah. And this is, again, a classic playbook for the communists, is it not? They do it.
That would be very familiar to China. Xi Jinping as well as Vladimir Putin.
Absolutely right. Brad, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to delve further into developments in China. You've been writing, as always, copious quantities of information and analyses and some very important recommendations about how we proceed. We need a new revolt of the admirals, as you put it. Stay tuned for that and much more with Dr. Bradley Thayer right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute, fresh from his pathetic impersonation of a representative of America's vital national interests in Beijing last week. Secretary of State Tony Blinken appeared on Sunday morning TV shows to comment on tumultuous events in Russia over the last few days. His message was, the Biden administration is, quote, focused on Ukraine, unquote. In fact, Blinken slavishly adhered to what was clearly his main authorized talking point by repeating it ludicrously. No wonder his international interlocutors, and most especially the Chinese communist ones, treat him with such contempt. If Team Biden has nothing to say about the import of the short-lived but portentous Russian mutiny besides, look over there, folks, at least our countrymen and women ought to be encouraged to focus on the fresh evidence that President Biden has personally taken money from Chinese intelligence officers and repeatedly lied about it. Joe must go. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Dr. Bradley Thayer of the Center for Security Policy is in the house. I'm very pleased to say he is one of our go-to guys on China, among other things. Brad, we were talking in the previous block a bit about China, but mostly about Russia. At the same time that all of this drama has been playing out, and perhaps obscuring it a bit, has been Xi Jinping's own gambit in Cuba. Give us your read on what's going on there at the moment and the response to date by the United States government.
Well, it's in some respects startling. In other respects, it should have been expected that Cuba is has developed an intelligence coup military facility in Cuba. And the Biden administration revealed this, and it was much like Jimmy Carter's revelation in 1979. Frank, some of us are old enough to remember that, when he revealed that a Soviet combat brigade had been discovered in Cuba. So this is an important base because it will not only help China's ability to collect intelligence, signals intelligence from U.S. sources, but it also is a strong symbol of support for the regime in Cuba. It provides China with the ability to interdict sea lines of communication and other lines of communication. And it shows that China's on the march in Central South America and the Caribbean, as well as globally. That is, the east wind is prevailing over the west wind if China, in fact, can establish this military and intelligence base in Cuba. And there's no doubt that China would seek to use Cuban influence, which remains considerable, as a legacy of the Cold War and the fact that really Cuban forces were paladins for the Warsaw Pact, for the Soviet Union, fighting in Angola, Ethiopia, Yemen, and other locations in the course of the Cold War. That's going to be memorable as well. So there was a huge political warfare victory achieved by China with this facility in Cuba. And the Biden administration's reaction has been, again, completely unacceptable, where Blinken, Frank, as you know well, said that he was monitoring the situation. Well, that is absolutely outrageous. There have to be coercive measures put in place to eject this facility from Cuba. And think strongly not just about the target itself, which would be to bring about regime change in China, targeting the Chinese Communist Party for destruction, but also recognizing that the Cuban government continues to abuse the Cuban people since 1959, of course, when communists came to power. That also has to be considered for coercive measures. And ideally to have that government leave and to have a democracy in Cuba, which would be obviously ideal.
Well, we were talking about the difficulties of knowing who would come next in Russia. I think there is a greater reason to believe that the people of Cuba would actually, if given their preferences, opt for democracy and a new start, especially in a relationship with the United States. We have to both pray and be working to help them, I think, in that end. Brad, you had a very interesting piece in American Greatness the other day with Captain Fennell about the cumulative failure of successive American presidents in both reckoning with the growing threat of the Chinese Communist Party, and for that matter, as we'll be talking about a bit more with our friend Bill Walton momentarily, enabling it. Give us a quick rundown on the legacy of this ineptitude and you know, the whirlwind we're now reaping as a result.
Indeed, Frank, I'm pleased to. James Fennell and I published a piece, as you observed, in American Greatness. Our argument was, first, post-Cold War presidents, Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, ruined what strategists, what previous American presidents built during World War II and the Cold War. And that was a secure America that was also a dominant America in international politics.
Pax Americana.
Yeah. And during this time, through the engagement school, Clinton specifically, certain decisions undertaken during the Clinton administration greatly facilitated the economic growth of China to the point now where, of course, it's a rival of the United States.
Notably, accession to the World Trade Organization, as well as shipping them all kinds of military technology, right?
Indeed. De-linking most favored nation trade status renewal from human rights, which in fact Nancy Pelosi wanted to continue, but it was the Clinton administration that de facto granted, without preconditions, most favored nation trade status renewal without any regard to making improvements in China's human rights or political changes. That was a very powerful tool, a very powerful tool that we possessed, that we essentially, Clinton, disarmed unilaterally as a consequence of that.
And presumably for compensation from the Chinese. I think what we saw at the time was campaign contributions at a minimum.
We saw the coffees. We saw a series of assorted events that took place in the run-up to the 96 election that Al Gore as vice president and Bill Clinton as president engaged in. And that really showed the emphasis that the Chinese Communist Party placed on this and the venality, of course, the corruption, Frank, of ultimately the engagement school, which we're engaging now. Now, de-risking of...
Go ahead. De-risking is one of the topics I wanted to hit with you. We'll be talking more about it again with Bill momentarily. But what on earth does that mean to you, Brad, in a relationship with China, which is fraught, to say the least? I mean, risk is what China represents to us of a greater and greater magnitude, no?
Indeed. It was de-risking is essentially engagement in a new guise.
Old wine in new bottles, as they are fond of saying in communist countries.
And Li Kuang, the prime minister of China, was in France and in Germany this weekend, and he was emphasizing...
The premier.
He was emphasizing, of course, that de-risking should not go too far as Europe tries to contemplate whether it should be so engaged with China. So it is, as a practical matter, de-risking is meaningless. It is essentially going to allow the engagement school to continue under the guise of an awareness of security, right, which is a false pretense and is very damaging, when in fact what we should do is not de-risk, but we should decouple in every respect from China as rapidly as possible. So when we have individuals like the CEO of Raytheon talk about the need that we need to minimize, we can minimize risk, but we could never decouple, this is, again, a symptom of this profound problem that we possess, that the engagement school has captured the economic ideas, the political ideas of the elite of the United States and of Europe. Incredibly pernicious idea.
And as you know, this is a central theme of our book, to which you've contributed mightily, Brad Thayer, titled The Indictment, Prosecuting China and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. Elite capture is insidious in the extreme. Brad, we've got 30 seconds Revolt of the Admirals. Remind us what that refers to and why we need one now.
Well, in 1949, there was a major debate between the Navy and the Air Force with respect to how nuclear weapons will be delivered against the Soviet Union. The Department of Defense, Truman's Department of Defense, selected the Air Force and the B-36 and the cancellation of the USS United States, which led to resignations by very senior and mid-level naval officers. So what we need today, James Fennell and I argue, is again, first, the recognition that China's Navy has grown while our Navy has not. Their capabilities have grown while our capabilities have not. They have increasingly capabilities and power projection. We lost it. What we need is we need flag-level officers and supporters to step forward and to say this has to be reversed.
This is leadership. It's wanting. We need it urgently. Brent Thayer, we'll have you back to talk more about it next week. Thank you, my friend. God bless
you. Thank you, Frank.
We'll be right back with Bill Walton right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say, as always, welcome to Bill Walton, one of our esteemed and regular contributors about this time each week. Bill, of course, is the host of the Bill Walton Television Podcast Program, a marvelous contribution to the public policy debate. You can see it at, among other places, cpac.org. He is also a man who brings a great deal of expertise from his time as a master of the universe on Wall Street. He ran Allied Capital, a $6 billion venture there, and knows a lot about what is being done to us, as well as with our money, by his former colleagues. Bill, it's great to have you with us, as always. Thank you for joining us.
Frank, as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you. It's not necessarily the topics we have, which are
that's true
at the moment.
Not always pleasant. Well, speaking of which, Bill, I just wanted to get a quick take. We were talking with Brad Thayer in the previous segment about this Russia upset. Any thoughts from you as to what's going on there and what it might portend?
Well, the Biden administration has been assiduously working to dislodge Putin from command of the Russian would-be empire, and it looks like with this internal fight, that may happen. We don't know. We haven't heard anything that's definitive from outside Russia or who's in charge, but it's a big problem because while we think it's great for him to be gone, it may not be. I mean, we do not know who would be end up in control of the nuclear button. We do know that China, that's had designs to work more closely with Russia in forming an alliance. President Xi's, China's relationship with Russia is based on Putin. So that all needs to be recalibrated. And it's made a dangerous situation even more dangerous. And in a way, I hate to root for Putin. He's a bad guy. But on the other hand, the instability this may create may be worse.
Yeah, the devil you know. Yeah, really is the operative phrase, I think, at the moment. And I guess the question is, who would be next? Prigozhin seems like a marked man to me. This chap who led his column some thousand armored vehicles, as I understand it, towards Moscow, and then was persuaded that that was not going to be a good thing to do. If he is not the successor, then it may be somebody of his ilk. And it's hard to imagine that it could be worse than Putin, given what we've seen in Ukraine, but it could be for sure. Yeah. And there's a perennial question as to whose finger would be on the button of all of those nuclear weapons as well. Bill, let's pivot to China, something that you are following closely and are very helpful with us each week describing. In particular, Bill, what we're hearing increasingly from government officials here, like Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, as well as some of your former comrades on Wall Street, is disengagement is just not possible from China. But what we are interested in doing is, quote, de-risking, unquote. I have no idea what that means in the context of communist China. Do you?
De-risking, that seems to be another term to add to our Orwellian vocabulary. De-risking, decoupling, disengaging, all these terms are trying to reckon with the fact that China's naked global ambitions have become quite apparent, and especially with their designs on Taiwan. And of course, if they attack Taiwan, the U.S. economy would likely collapse because of our dependence on Taiwanese semiconductors. In fact, the world economy would likely collapse. So this is more than just a local tinderbox we need to worry about. The administration and a lot of the other elites in the military, and the industrial complex, financial companies, they're loath to give up their commitment to China. Fortunes have been made dealing with China. The whole calculation that the U.S. government's made in the last 15, 20 years has been to cozy up to China. And now it's clear that that is not working, didn't work, won't work. And so Yellen...
More to the point, is actually dangerous, I think. Talk about risk. There's huge risk associated with it, as we discussed most weeks.
People are waking up to it. And, you know, these are not dumb people. There are a lot of smart people running these big organizations, and they see what's happening with China now in a way they may not have before. But the lack of recognition, Blinken went over to bow down to President Xi last week, and he came away saying things like, or he said things during it like, China's broad economic success is also in America's interest. Well, I don't know what playbook he's operating from, but China's broad economic interest is not the same as ours. And
that was the narrative for decades in terms of this engagement. We just want to make them richer, and that will be good for obviously the people of China, but also for us. And I thought basically, Bill, I mean, to the point of understanding risk, we've come, at least smart people have come to the conclusion that actually making them richer is just making them more dangerous. No?
Well, for U.S. investors, I'm not allowed to give investment advice, but remember that your allocation to China should be zero. And corporations and investors in China increasingly realize if something does happen to Taiwan, they might as well write their investment to zero. So that's what they mean by de-risking. But the reality is we've got $2 or $3 trillion invested in China, American entities do, and getting out of that is not going to happen overnight. It's not going to even happen over decades. So we're intertwined. And that was all part of Chinese strategy all along. I'm reading an excellent book now. Bob Lighthizer, former U.S. trade representative, has written a book called No Trade is Free. I highly recommend it for both the history of what our trade policies were, but also his clear-eyed recognition of China. And he points out that in China, all the way back, there's never been a company or entity in China that's not directly or indirectly controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. So we've been wandering in thinking we're going to engage in deals with China, make money. I say we, the would-be investors and people would benefit from China. It just hasn't happened. And as we're seeing now, Xi is eager to jettison a lot of outside investment and being very aggressive about, you know, shutting down due diligence firms in China and making China basically investable And that's on purpose. And he no longer thinks that economic growth is his prime agenda item, but what instead is autonomy and controlling critical technologies that he would need for a kinetic war.
Right. And that's really the point. The risk, the ultimate risk that we have to be concerned with is that he is on a mission to dominate the world.
I'm trying to put myself in a position of somebody who's running a big public company or multinational, and they've really got themselves in a situation where they don't think they can get out. The CEO of Raytheon explained just last week that getting out of China is just not going to happen. He said we can de-risk or de-engage, but not decouple. Now again, we're getting into this word game, but basically, Western manufacturers have got their supply chain so intertwined with China. And remember, if you have a couple thousand parts that go into any machine that you're manufacturing, whether it's an airplane or a computer or a television, just one or two key components can shut it down. I mean, we saw that during the pandemic lockdowns, where the delivery basically stopped of key things because they said we couldn't get XYZ semiconductor or critical part out of China. So I think every CEO probably now, their board of directors and their investors is saying to them, what's our exposure? Can we get out? And the answer is, and the realistic answer is, with great difficulty. And so that's even somebody who wants to do that, has got good intentions, has American interest at stake, has got a very, very, very tricky problem.
Yeah. Well, it's of some concern, and I don't know whether the CEO of Raytheon is talking about his own company or not, but if one of our major defense contractors
is talking about not getting out of China,
that's a very worrying thing, no?
Well, our defense industry, our manufacturers depend on China for critical components. I mean, the Pentagon's
what could possibly go wrong?
Well, yeah.
Everything.
What they do when they procure things is they try to buy a lifetime supply of whatever critical components there are in case the supply chain gets cut off. But even that's not enough because you never really know what you need and how long you're going to need it for.
Or what's actually in it. One of our favorite object lessons in this regard is we have now, by some estimates, 400 Chinese manufactured high voltage transformers in our electric grid. And as I understand it, at least two of them have been taken apart, and turns out, surprise, surprise, there are back doors that would allow the Chinese to remotely destroy them or at least turn them off, which could have dire effects on our electricity distribution system, needless to say. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I want to talk to you about Syngenta, a company that is coming to market, and the U.S. may not be able to participate in that. What that says about Chinese changes to their market and implications for decoupling. We'll talk with you about that next week, though. Thank you, my friend, for all your help. God bless you and great work at the Bill Walton Show. Keep it up. Come back to us next week. Be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute, fresh from his pathetic impersonation of a representative of America's vital national interests in Beijing last week. Secretary of State Tony Blinken appeared on Sunday morning TV shows to comment on tumultuous events in Russia over the last few days. His message was, the Biden administration is, quote, focused on Ukraine, unquote. In fact, Blinken slavishly adhered to what was clearly his main authorized talking point by repeating it ludicrously. No wonder his international interlocutors, and most especially the Chinese communist ones, treat him with such contempt. If Team Biden has nothing to say about the import of the short-lived but portentous Russian mutiny besides, look over there, folks, at least our countrymen and women ought to be encouraged to focus on the fresh evidence that President Biden has personally taken money from Chinese intelligence officers and repeatedly lied about it. Joe must go. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we're joined by another of our friends and colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow of that organization by the name of Dr. Stephen Bryan, a man I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for, well, the better part of 35 years, I believe.
Initially
on Capitol Hill, where he was in senior positions in the United States Senate staff, as well as subsequently as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Technology Security. He has in the intervening period been a very prominent leader in the defense industrial sector, as well as a profoundly important commentator and author, including of a book that he published for our Center for Security Policy Press entitled Stopping a Taiwan Invasion. Dr. Bryan, it's always good to have you with us, especially at a time such as this. Welcome, sir.
Well, these are interesting times. Nice to be with you, Frank.
They are in the meaning of that Chinese expression. It's not necessarily a good thing. Let's start with Russia. Steve, I know you have been discussing, as have I, with Andrei Ilarionov, some of his insights based on his time working with Vladimir Putin as to what has happened in the past few days. We spoke of this with Brad Thayer earlier in the program, but I'd like to get your take on what you think is afoot at the moment, and what comes next?
Well, you know, it's very hard to parse all this because we don't have a lot of information. We have the physical information. We saw what happened in Russia, in Rostov-on-Don, and then Voronezh, and then the march to Moscow. We saw that. We saw the deal struck with Lukashenko in Belarus acting as mediator. We saw Prigozhin go off to Belarus eventually with 8,000 of his guys. Of the Wagner group, 8,000 participated in this, what can we call it, March on Moscow. March for Justice,
so-called mutiny.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you know, if it happened here, it would be an awful thing. And I guess if it happens in Russia, it's an awful thing. Now, I think Prigozhin was hoping that there would be an uprising in the country, and that people would support him, and that the military, parts of the military, and certainly parts of the intelligence apparatus would support him. And he was betting on that. More than betting on that, from what I have learned so far, he was in touch with foreign intelligence agencies, starting with Ukraine, but I think including the CIA, looking for assistance and saying he was going to win and saying he could settle the Ukraine thing. I think those were the keys to what he was promoting. But there was no uprising, none at all. And, you know, basically he was faced with annihilation or make a deal. It wasn't very much in between.
Not an appetizing choice.
Not at all.
You had, I guess, Rostov-on-Don, you had, you know, people at least applauding him on his way out of the city.
He's a hero in Russia because of what he did in Bakhmut. You know, he took the city. And that made him a hero. And, you know, there are not very many heroes in Russia these days. I mean, a lot of the military were severely criticized for their failures in Ukraine.
So he's a hero. He's comported himself on the battlefield with some distinction, at least relatively speaking. He would presumably, having taken this deal, now be a marked man. And I guess the question is, what comes next, Steve? Do you have any reading on that?
Not really. There are different theories going around. You know, you can have select the one you like. One of them is that he will end up helping Lukashenko deal with the threat of a coup in Belarus. That's one possibility. It is true, according to the news today, that in Belarus they're building camps for around 8,000 Wagner fighters. So they're meaning to have them stay there, and they obviously they want to put them to use. So I think that's probably credible. Now, that doesn't solve the problem of how compromised Prigozhin probably was with foreign intelligence agencies and what that means to Russia.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Presumably, his hero status would be greatly diminished if he's treating with the Ukrainian intelligence service, for heaven's sake, to say nothing of the CIA.
Well, there's no doubt about the Ukrainian one. The CIA one is... to be blunt, I mean, the Ukrainians don't do much of anything without working with us because they have to. And so some initiative like this, which had to do with the future of Ukraine, would have certainly been passed to the CIA. And that's why you read in the newspapers that the CIA had advanced knowledge and that they went around briefing the president and the Congress and the other military leaders that this coup is coming, because they knew it, because they were told by Prigozhin. That's the easy answer.
That's the best kind of intelligence is if the
from the horse's mouth,
the other guy tips his mitt. Yeah. So, Steve, I guess the issue is, and I know you've been skeptical about the whole Ukraine conflict, whether this makes any material difference in the prospects there. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, that's an interesting question because we don't know yet. Right now, the Russian forces are still fighting, and you know, it seems, although they've lost a little ground in the last few days, but that's not too surprising given the circumstances. But the big picture is what the Russian army decides to do, and how Putin interacts with them. Because I think if there's anyone who's suffered serious defeat in this, is Putin. It will allow something like, he let this go way too long. He didn't intervene when it was obviously this guy was doing that. They must have known. There's no way they wouldn't have known.
Sure. If this guy's talking to our intelligence services, I imagine his were clued up as well.
Well, I mean, they're pretty good. I mean, and anyway, they had top Russian military leaders in the Wagner group. I mean, they had Suravikin, who, General Suravikin, is a very powerful, strong Russian general. Not a nice guy, but strong. And you know, and he's the one that when they put a gun to his head, he told them, I'm not supporting this. When the Wagner people put a gun to his head, he went on a video sitting with a machine pistol in his hand saying, look, guys, don't do this. A big mistake. We shouldn't do. We don't fight against our own people.
Hold the thought, Steve. We'll be right back with more with Steve and Brian right after this.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Stephen Bryan, former senior Defense Department official, a man who knows his way around Washington and the defense national security beats. And we're speaking to him about Russia and what is happening there and what it might mean for, well, Ukraine most immediately and possibly for us as well. And Steve, I just wanted to say you had a very interesting piece in Asia Times recently in which you talked about this so-called offensive. I guess it's not a spring offensive anymore, as this is now summer, but what the Ukrainians are running into in the way of heavily fortified defensive positions along the Russian front. And while there seems to be, as you mentioned, you know, some slight changes in where the front line is day by day, it doesn't seem as though this is going anywhere. Is that your assessment at the moment?
Yeah, that's still my assessment. The Russians have held pretty well, way above their main defense line. So they're very secure, it seems to me. They have air power. Ukraine doesn't. Ukraine's air defenses also have been largely destroyed by the Russians. And so, you know, and at the end of the day, they have more people, you know, and more mass. So, you know, if you just look at it from a very objective point of view, it's not a good story for the Ukrainians. I think the Ukrainians are betting, this is my guess, on a NATO intervention. That's what they want. And they're going to do almost anything they can to get one. Yet I think it would be a terrible mistake for NATO to do that, because it would trigger a European war, and that's unbelievably dangerous. So that's the story. I mean, and I talked about what happened in 1943 at Kursk in my article. Kursk was a huge battle over many, many miles, where the Nazis thought they could, you know, drive all the way up to, from Kursk all the way up to Moscow. And they were stopped by the Russians at huge cost. The Russians lost a lot of people, but the Nazis lost their firepower, and they had no more. It's sort of like having these Western tanks in Ukraine. I mean, they couldn't do it, and they couldn't break. And it finally turned the war around, at least on the Eastern Front, where the Russians then could start moving in against the Nazis and push them out of Russia and eventually go to Berlin.
Right. And the rest, as they say,
the rest is history.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Steve, history is being made on another front as well, and that is with respect to communist China. You did a devastating critique, I think it's fair to say, of Tony Blinken's sojourn in Beijing last week. Again, we talked a little bit about this with Brad, but I'd be very interested in your take specifically about how the Chinese now are perceiving not just Blinken, obviously,
but the
Biden administration, but yeah, our country more broadly. Yeah.
Well, China's a mess right now. I mean, Chinese economy has crashed in many respects. They have huge internal problems. Xi is, you know, he did all these things to try and reform things, and he's made a mess, and people are very angry. A lot of people are out of work. People are hungry. I mean, we had a lot of leverage, you know, for Blinken to go there, which I wasn't so sure was wise, but for Blinken to go there at all, you have to use that leverage. I mean, you want us to help you? Okay, this is what we want. You know, here's my list. Can we reconcile the two? I mean, he didn't do that. He went there apologizing for the balloon that flew over our nuclear bases. What are you talking about? Apologizing for that.
Case closed.
Case closed. Go away. We don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, seemingly turning a blind eye to what's going on in Cuba and making excuses on and on. I mean,
yeah. Well, first,
I don't know whether it was clear that the idea was that he was there to offer help to a struggling China, or whether he was there to kowtow to
Xi. He was there to kowtow. But keep in mind that the administration is, you know, while it's saying it's anti-China, is in fact very much for trade with China. 100%. And they've been bringing Chinese delegations to the financial centers in New York and Washington over the past weeks, you know, trying to work deals.
Yeah.
So they knew all that.
And encouraging U.S. capitalists to go there too. Yeah.
Well, and to invest more and to bail them out, you know, all these things. I mean, so Bill Gates is a hero in China, you know, that kind of nonsense. So is Elon Musk, which he may regret. So I think that what you see is that the administration is trying to fool the American people to believe that, you know, we can be tough with China, when in fact we're not being tough at all. We're giving away the farm. That's my opinion.
No, I think that's exactly right. So, Steve, about this Cuba business, you know a lot about intelligence and about, you know, the capabilities that a forward-deployed military base on an island 90 miles off our shore could constitute. What's your assessment, your threat assessment of what the Chinese are up to and how serious a problem it will represent?
Well, we have to watch it carefully, because will they introduce nuclear weapons to Cuba is going to be the big issue, it seems to me. They always have the possibility of intelligence gathering there, but I don't think that's that they have so many ways to do intelligence gathering that that's sort of secondary today. I think the primary is
it has a reputation. Well, it was lords of collecting a lot of intelligence and data, right?
Yeah, it was a great big listening post. But, you know, the times have changed now. And now you can get on the internet what you used to be able to have to get off the radio waves. So it's probably easier to do it. The Chinese are very good at stealing everything off the internet. Now, I don't think it's about intelligence. I think it's first opportunistic. Let's put a dagger at the throat of Washington. You know, let them know we're really close to them. We're not 10,000 miles away. We're in their backyard. And secondly, there's the threat they could introduce in a moment's notice nuclear weapons.
So, well, Steve, let me ask you.
U.S. are not complaining. Look, the Biden administration lied about it. They said, oh, no, there's nothing going on. And then when they heard there was something, they couldn't get away from it. They said, oh, yeah, but it started way before.
And Trump. Trump's watch.
Yeah, everything's blamed on Trump.
Steve, we have to have you back to talk further about this, because among other things, I'm concerned about containerized missiles that could be nuclear armed, having already been sent in containers. But that's for another day. Thank you, my friend. God bless you.
Take care.
Keep up the great work with us at the Center for Security Policy and elsewhere. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll do so again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.